And he's like, hi. And I'm like, hi. And he's like, are you on your own? And I'm like, yes. And he's like, no way. And I'm like, it's true. And he's like, I don't believe you. And I'm like, come on. And he's like, I'm serious. And I'm like, cut it out. And he's like, am I embarrassing you? And I'm like, can we stop? And he's like, I saw you come in. And I'm like, okay. And he's like,
okay,
can I get a drink? And I'm like, that'd be
Brandy,
great.
Brandy, I think we're on the air now, honey.
Whatever.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry, our sound engineers brought us in a tad early there. I was just discussing some fine points of political science with one of my research assistants. Well, here we are again, heading into Christmas with Radio Derb. This is your seasonally genial host, John Derbyshire, with all the news of the hour, courtesy of National Review Online. Our splendid state-of-the-art recording studio here on the 95th floor of Buckley Towers is all decked out with festive decorations, including, new this year, some balloons and lights for the Islamic festival of Eid al-Adha. Ahmed, our Muslim diversity hire, is still on leave of absence, attending to some urgent family business in northern Pakistan, but his resident attorney, Mr. Mohammed Mohammed Al-Mohammed, insisted on the Eid decorations, and we were, of course, happy to comply. Very happy. Very, very happy. Weren't we, girls?
Of course!
Right, on with the show. That was some actual drunken sailors. Here is the latest news on the fiscal front. On Wednesday, the House of Representatives voted 218-214 to give the federal government the ability to borrow $290 billion to finance its operations for just 6 additional weeks. That's about $1,000 per person in the USA, men, women and children. $1,000 for 6 weeks. Next story. That very same House of Representatives, also on Wednesday, voted 217-212 to approve additional spending for shovel-ready construction projects and more money to avoid layoffs of teachers, police, and other public employees. So, if you're an illegal immigrant looking for construction work, the government's got your back. Likewise, if you're a government worker, the rest of us can go fish. After, of course, ponying up the $500 per capita to fund all that spending. Oh, here's another spending story. President Barack Obama has signed into law a $1.1 trillion bill that increases government budgets for health, law enforcement, and veterans programs by about 10%. Obama signed the bill privately at the White House on Wednesday, we learn. $1.1 trillion is about $4,000 a head. Get your checkbooks out, citizens. Uncle Sam needs your money. He'll spend it much more wisely than you could. What is he actually spending it on? Well, a lot of it's going to pay raises for government employees. Quote from USA Today, December 12th, quote, when the recession started, the Transportation Department had only one person earning a salary of $170,000 or more. 18 months later, 1,690 employees had salaries above $170,000. End quote. Oh, but here's another one. Quote, the growth in six-figure salaries has pushed the average federal worker's pay to $71,206. Compared with $40,331 in the private sector. Yes, we may have lost 8 million jobs in the private sector, but up there in D.C., it's party time.
Happy birthday! Happy birthday! Happy birthday!
Now, of course, not all that boodle is being shunted into the pockets of federal employees. No, sir. Some of it's being put to good use. Our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, over there at the climate conference in Copenhagen,
salty old queen of the sea,
has signed us up to the Climate Protection Fund, budgeted at $100 billion a year. The USA won't be paying the whole tab, but you can be sure we'll get stuck with the biggest part of it, just as we do with the UN and refugee programs and every other one of those damn fool international initiatives. Meanwhile, the Copenhagen talks themselves have got stuck. As revealed by Radio Derb last week, the whole climate change business is fundamentally a shakedown of guilty liberals in rich countries by grievance manipulators in poor ones. The problem here seems to be that too many not-so-poor countries like China and Brazil have joined the really poor ones in the shakedown. Western liberals are willing to hand over their cash, along with, of course, your cash and my cash, when they see pictures of starving kids in Ethiopia with big sad eyes and flies on their faces. But not so much when the person demanding the handout has an $8 trillion gross domestic product and holds $800 billion worth of your treasury securities. The Earth's climate itself added to the general air of anticlimax, dumping 4 inches of snow on Copenhagen Wednesday night. This is pretty unusual. Copenhagen hasn't had a white Christmas for 14 years, and only had 7 in the whole 20th century. But, as we all know by now, global warming means a lot of global cooling. In related news, Oceania is at war with East Asia. Oceania has always been at war with East Asia. No matter how much of our money the federal government spends, it won't bankrupt the USA. What will bankrupt the USA would be if Congress fails to pass healthcare reform. So, at least, the president told an interviewer on ABC News. If the healthcare reform package isn't passed, the president told Charles Gibson, healthcare costs are going to consume the entire federal budget. I have a couple of issues with that statement, one philosophical and one mathematical. The philosophical issue is that the president's claim violates a fundamental law of nature, the one that says things that can't happen won't. The mathematical issue is that since the federal budget is expanding so fast, it's going to be hard for expanding healthcare costs to catch up. Leaving those objections aside, where are the prospects for the healthcare legislation? Up in the air, that's where. The big news this week has been the flight of the lefties. Oh yes, I know, that's the flight of the bumblebee. I couldn't find a music clip called Flight of the Lefties. Here's one of the lefties, Howard Dean. That's the guy. In a Washington Post op-ed Thursday, Dino spoke up for, what do they call themselves? Oh yes, progressives. Quote from him. I know healthcare reform when I see it, and there isn't much left in the Senate bill. End quote. Speaking as one lapsed Anglican to another, Dino, I know a lefty poseur when I see one. Dino's home state of Vermont is crawling with them. Here's another one. Bernie Sanders, Vermont's junior senator, who's so far left he doesn't even bother to say progressive, declaring himself, frankly, to be a socialist. Bernie took time out from polishing his collection of KGB belt buckles to tell journalists, quote, as of this point, I'm not voting for the bill. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, on into the Valley of Death rode Harry Reid and his valiant Light Brigade.
Forward, the Light Brigade! Was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the Valley of Death rode the 600.
People, even the kind of thoughtful, cultured, well-informed and perfectly proportioned people who listen to Radio Derb, people don't realise how many wild and woolly characters from the remote caves and gullies of the far, far, far left have been appointed to senior positions by Barack Obama. To mention a few at random. Regulatory Tsar and media fairness doctrine advocate Cass Sunstein. Labour policy Tsar William Spriggs, who once expressed his disappointment that black immigrants don't feel sufficiently victimised. Science Tsar John Holdren, who wants government-mandated family sizes and the de-development of the United States. Drug Tsar Gil Kerlikowske, whose career as Seattle police chief was crowned by a vote of confidence in him among Seattle police officers, in which 90% of the officers voted no. Tootsie Roll fortune heiress Karen Mills, appointed to run the Small Business Administration, in spite of the fact that her own numerous attempts at running a business were all swift and comprehensive failures. What a menagerie! Ward Churchill, Louis Farrakhan and Squeaky Fromm must be wondering why they've been passed over. Well, here's another horse from the same stable. Safe Schools Tsar Kevin Jennings. Did you know that the US government has a Safe Schools Tsar? I didn't either. You see, the Federal Department of Education, the Jimmy Carter administration's gift to posterity, goes from strength to strength, hiring more bureaucrats, opening more sub-departments, expanding its power and authority through countless offshoots. Among this demon spawn of the Carter administration is one named the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools. That office naturally needs a secretary, hence the Safe Schools Tsar. The person actually holding the title of Tsar is the aforementioned Kevin Jennings, appointed in May by President Obama. What is Tsar Jennings' notion of a safe school? I'll give you a clue. Before rising to high office, Jennings had devoted himself to an organisation that he had founded called the Gay, Lesbian and Straight Education Network, GLSEN. The mission of GLSEN, to put it in a nutshell, is to teach public school children that gay is just as good as straight. They send activists into schools to show the kids how to perform homosexual acts. That's not an exaggeration, it's what they do. They also push a recommended reading list of books they want K-12 kids to read. Reporters have been looking into some of those books. They are, again, to put it in a nutshell, homosexual pornography, with graphic accounts of every kind of homosexual encounter, and very little else. The GLSEN folk seem particularly keen to promote an activity so disgusting as to be unmentionable on a family radio show, but described in John Heidenreich's 1997 book about the sexual revolution, titled What Wild Ecstasy, as, quote, the first original sex practice in centuries. So, now you know what the Obama administration's definition of a safe school is. It's a school where adult homosexuals can safely proselytize buggery to seventh graders. Remember NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement? Well, it's 15 years old this year. On January 1st this year, to be precise. But studies covering the first 15 years of NAFTA have just come out. Here's one from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The title of the study is Rethinking Trade Policy for Development: Lessons from Mexico under NAFTA. So, what do the Carnegie eggheads tell us? What has NAFTA done for Mexico? Precious little, apparently. In fact, possibly less than nothing. Mexico's trade balance in 1994 was negative 4% of GDP. Before last year's crash, it was actually lower than that, and now, of course, it's lower still, around negative 7%. Manufacturing employment was pretty much flat across the entire period to last year's crash, and now it's actually below 1994 levels, which is more of a problem than it sounds, as around 1 million Mexicans enter the labour force every year, and agriculture has shed over 2 million jobs in the period. NAFTA was supposed to help close the wage gap between Mexico and the USA. Instead, the gap has actually widened, from a ratio of 5.6 in 1993 to 5.8 in 2007. Quote from the report's executive summary, quote, "The evidence points overwhelmingly to the conclusion that Mexico's reforms, backed by NAFTA, have largely been a disappointment for the country." End quote. The premise of NAFTA, as of all trade liberalizing policies, is that if obstacles to free trade and migration are removed, there is no reason why one country shouldn't do just as well as another. Well, nigh every economist in the world believes this theory. Well, the theory just had a 15-year field test right here in North America. And guess what? It's wrong. Now, of course, all the economists will abandon the theory. They will go back to their models and their databases and work up a new theory. That's what they'll do, isn't it? Of course it is. Every conservative should memorize Rudyard Kipling's poem, Arithmetic on the Frontier. The frontier in question is the Northwest Indian frontier, the same place where we are now fighting against the Taliban. Kipling compares the relative cost of educating, training and supporting a British soldier compared with the cost of a local Muslim guerrilla. Here's a sample. I need to explain that the word jezail that you're going to hear is a kind of musket favoured by 19th century Afghan fighters. The rupee is the Indian currency. 10 rupees was worth $3 or $4 in Kipling's time. Okay, here we go. "A great and glorious thing it is to learn for 7 years or so, the Lord knows what of that and this, ere reckoned fit to face the foe. The flying bullet down the pass that whistles clear, all flesh is grass. A scrimmage in a border station, a canter down some dark defile, £2,000 of education drops to a 10-rupee jezail." With that in mind, let us compare the cost of a Taliban fighter with the cost of a NATO soldier. The CIA has the numbers. They estimate that Taliban leaders and their associates had received $106 million in the past year from donors outside Afghanistan, with private citizens from Pakistan, Iran, and Arab nations being the largest individual contributors. On top of that, the Taliban make a lot of money from trafficking in opium, although estimates of how much vary widely, from $70 to $400 million a year. Let's take the higher number to be fair. Taliban total income is then around $500 million a year. There are about 12,000 active Taliban fighters, so the cost per fighter is a maximum $40,000 a year. The United States has spent $234 billion on the war over 9 years, $26 billion a year. Divide that by our current 68,000 personnel in the field, it comes to nearly $400,000 a year. Bottom line, even if you don't factor in the expensive training and education, a NATO fighter costs at least 10 times as much as a Talibani. There you are. Arithmetic on the frontier, brought up to date. Of course, spending 10 times as much per fighter, we're bound to win, right? Well, we should hope so. I think the Afghan war is stupid and pointless. As a patriot, though, I don't want to see my country lose a war, even a stupid and pointless one. Which was pretty much Kipling's position as it happens. So, back to Kipling. What did he think? Here's another quote from the poem. Strike hard who cares, shoot straight who can. The odds are on the cheaper man. Yet another in our readings from this year's Christmas blockbuster bestseller, We Are Doomed, Reclaiming Conservative Pessimism. Here we are in Chapter 9, where the subject is war. I have just got through a brief discussion of President George W. Bush's second inaugural address, the one with all those grandiose assertions about, quote, ending tyranny in our world. I continue thus. For anything equivalent to the wilder assertions in Bush's second inaugural, you have to go back not just to times of real war, or Cold War, with real nations, but to liberal and progressive presidents fighting those wars. Woodrow Wilson told Congress in January 1918 that, quote, the people of the United States are ready to devote their lives, their honor, and everything that they possess to vindicate the principle of justice to all peoples and nationalities, end quote. John F. Kennedy declared in his own inaugural that, quote, we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, in order to assure the survival and the success of liberty, end quote. Bush seemed to be dimly aware of the problem. After every proclamation of intent to end tyranny, or to liberate Muslim women from humiliation and servitude, there was a little escape clause. That ultimate goal of ending tyranny, quote, is the concentrated work of generations. Phew, so we don't have to get on it like right now. That call of freedom, quote, liberty will come to those who love it, end quote. Oh, so it's a sort of God helps those who help themselves deal. So we may not have to do the heavy lifting after all. Liberating those gals from their burqas, quote, when the soul of a nation finally speaks, the institutions that arise may reflect customs and traditions very different from our own, end quote. Best not cut up those burqas for halter tops just yet, ladies. That second inaugural showed that the president regarded foreign policy as another aspect of the principle he had offered us here at home, compassionate conservatism, which my National Review colleague John O'Sullivan correctly tagged as less a political philosophy than a romantic cult of sensibility. I think even that is making too much of it. While compassionate conservatism began its life as a kind of Orthodox Catholic response to leftist liberation theology, as practiced by the Bush administration, it was really just an outgrowth of boomer hedonism. If it feels good, do it. And if it sounds good, say it. Rational calculation of the national interest was barely present. The driving force here was feelings. Woe, 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 feelings. And now our traditional closing miscellany of brief items. Item: a Mexican drug boss was killed in a shootout when his apartment building was raided by 200 sailors of the Mexican Navy. This was in Cuernavaca, just south of Mexico City, on Wednesday. It's always good to see a gangster get his ticket punched, but the thing that caught my eye there was that the deed was done by the Mexican Navy. Who knew Mexico had a navy? Not me. Well, things must be looking up down there. Next thing you know, they'll have an economy. Item: Silvio Berlusconi, said to be Tiger Woods' favourite Italian politician, was attacked by a lunatic in Milan. The lunatic whacked Berlusconi in the face with a small model of the local cathedral. Milan's cathedral is one of the spikier ones, so this must have hurt. Still, Silvio should count his blessings. It might have been a Muslim fanatic with a model of a local mosque. You know, the kind with lots of minarets. Which is not a thing the Swiss Prime Minister has to worry about. Item: Anise Parker was elected mayor of Houston, the first openly lesbian person to attain the office. The deeper lesson of the vote is not that Houstonians want a lesbian mayor, but that Houstonians couldn't care less who gets to be mayor. Only 16% of the electorate turned out to vote. Radio Derb extends congratulations to Ms. Parker. We shall do our best to dispel some of the rumours that are flying around. For example, that city employees will now have to come to work by motorbike, and that softball will be the city's official sport, and so on. False, false, all of them. Item: two stories this week on the continuing ethnic disaggregation of the United States, the process that will break up our country at last. The legislature and judiciary are, of course, fully on board with it, so that should speed things up. Here on the legislative front, the ACACA bill has passed out of Senate committee and will go to the full House and Senate for votes. This is the bill that establishes Hawaiians as a legally recognized race, with race-based privileges and immunities. If Hawaiians can attain this status in federal law, I see no reason in logic or jurisprudence why other races should not. The Hmong, perhaps, or Irish Americans, or Latinos. The ACACA bill has, it goes without saying, the wholehearted support of President Obama. Item: the grain of sand in the oyster there, the original sin from which all this granting of racial privileges will flow, is the recognition of American Indian tribes as self-governing nations. Really, the Hawaiians are just being made honorary Indians, as the Hmong, the Latinos, and other racial subgroups eventually will be, although I suspect we British Americans will be down at the end of the line. The lunacy of treating Indians as a separate privileged class of citizens based on their race went a step further here on Long Island last week, when the Shinnecock Indian tribe out on the east of the island were told that they could apply for federal recognition. The 1,000 members of the tribe live on 800 acres. That's 1.25 square miles. Out there by Southampton, where all the celebrities have their summer houses. The tribe claims great swathes of land out there, and they plan to open casinos, this apparently being the only form of enterprise at which Native Americans can excel. The first thing, not the only thing, but the first thing that Long Islanders will tell you about the Shinnecock is that their Indian heritage is highly theoretical. They are, in fact, mostly African American. If you don't believe me, Google up a picture of Randy King, the Shinnecock tribal chairman. He's blacker than Barack Obama. This business of tribes is a racket on at least 17 different levels. How about we just all become citizens with equal rights under the law? What a quaint idea. Item. Finally, a new wrinkle on the diversity front. I know that Radio Derb listeners celebrate diversity and are keenly aware of the immeasurable pain and suffering caused by insufficient sensitivity to those differences that divide us. Unite us. Whatever. Anyway, here's a new sin to bear in mind next time you go into the confessional at your local temple of diversity. The sin of gingerism. Tesco's, a supermarket chain in Britain, and as it happens a former employer of mine, Tesco's sells a line of jokey Christmas cards for kids. One of them pokes fun at redheads with the message, quote, "Santa loves all kids, even ginger ones." This ignited the wrath of Davinia Phillips, who lives in York. That's old York, not New York. And who is the mother of three red-headed children. She lodged a complaint with the authorities against what she calls gingerism. Quote from her. "Maybe I'm just being naive, but they shouldn't be able to make fun of ginger children like that." End quote. "No, you're not being naive, Mrs. Phillips. You're just being the kind of hypersensitive, narcissistic, hysterical nitwit that modern Western society expects you to be." Tesco has now withdrawn the offending card, and senior executives of the firm are walking in solemn procession through the streets of York, flagellating themselves and being spat on by passers-by for their shameful gingerism. One newspaper columnist over there referred to Mrs. Phillips as a ginger whinger. Fortunately, the authorities were alerted before this mean-spirited bigot could do further damage to the fabric of society, and he has been hustled off to a re-education camp in the Shetland Islands. Diversity is our strength. Well, there you are, citizens. And when I say citizens, I of course mean no disrespect whatsoever to resident non-citizens, diplomatic or consular officers, temporary visitors, aliens in transit, maritime crew members, persons of extraordinary artistic, scientific, athletic or entertainment ability, treaty investors, holders of student visas, accredited representatives of international organizations, spouses, children, fiancés, attendants, servants or personal employees of the aforementioned, or our brothers and sisters in the undocumented community. We are especially sensitive to that last category, aren't we, Pepe?
Si, senor.
Yes, diversity-wise, I think we are covered here. Or at least we shall be when Ahmed returns from that trip to Pakistan. Let's hope he gets back in time to celebrate holiday with us.